I'm really liking the idea of being beyond the flap. I've always felt I was a bit beyond the flap, really. Thank you very much for being here today in what must be quite uncomfortable conditions to hear a little more of what I have to say. And I'm talking, of course, the title today is the title of my new book, The Bad Christian's Manifesto, Reinventing God and Other Modest Proposals. Now, earlier this year, I had the privilege, and I do count it a privilege, actually, of taking the funeral of Ronnie Biggs, the great train robber. I'd met Ronnie a year before that when I took the funeral of Bruce Reynolds, who's renowned as the mastermind of the great train robbery, and I actually read out Ronnie's tribute to Bruce at that funeral. So I met Ronnie a little bit and had chance to just at least make a little bit of connection with him. And then when he died, they asked if I would take his funeral. And after the funeral, we went round to a pub round the corner where the bouncers were 12 Hell's Angels who led the cortege for Ronnie Biggs. I'm not quite sure why, but they made a lot of noise, and they were quite sort of fierce-looking people. And actually, to get into the pub that day, you had to show them a piece of Monopoly money, which we were given. That was the ticket, you know. So that was fun. And I had some amazing conversations with people there, talking about God as I understand and believe in God. And one person there, who's a member of a band called Alabama 3, who sang at the funeral, said to me, "I've never been able to believe in God, but if God is like you describe, like you have demonstrated to us today, then I do believe in God." And actually, the week after the funeral, I baptized Ronnie's little granddaughter, Lily, who had never been christened, and family said, "We'd really like you to take the christening." And so one of the Hell's Angels came to the christening. His name's Ian, a big guy, you know, all dimensions. And he had heard that since I took Ronnie's funeral, I got quite a number of emails and Facebook messages from people who were disgusted at me taking the funeral of this kind of infamous... Sorry? They say it'll feed back if it goes up any higher. But can you hear me now? A little bit better? Hello, hello. So, pin your ears back. So Ian, this big Hell's Angel, had heard that I'd had these kind of abusive emails from Christians who were sort of saying, "How can you celebrate the life of this infamous criminal?" Not that I thought I was celebrating his life, actually. And so Ian said to me, "I've heard that you've been getting threats, Dave, after taking Ronnie's funeral." So I said, "Well, you know, not really threats." So he said, "The boys weren't happy about that." So he said, "If you have any more trouble, Dave, you just contact me. So if you're tempted to heckle me today, be warned." So my book is really focused much more on this subject of God. What sort of God can we believe in? What kind of picture or experience do we have of God? And more particularly, how can we reinvent God or reinvent the image of God that we may have into something that is more redemptive rather than, as it often is, I think, destructive? No one will forget Jim's funeral, the one where the Sex Pistols showed up instead of Frank Sinatra. Despite a rainstorm that day of near biblical proportions, more than 300 people arrived at the crematorium. Those who couldn't squeeze into the chapel peered through the open door from the entrance hall, rather like people are here today. Some even stood outside in the rain, listening to the service relayed from speakers. Grief strikes hard when a person dies young, and at just 35 years, it felt like Jim's life had barely begun. When six of his friends carried the coffin into the chapel, the sobs and moans were so loud that I could scarcely make myself heard. But then, little by little, the tears and groans morphed into smiles and laughter when one speaker after another related funny and moving accounts of Jim's short but eventful life. The stories and tributes over, I invited the congregation to join me in commending Jim to God's loving care. Nothing now remained but for me to hit the button that would send Jim on his way. Glancing toward the chapel attendant at the back, I nodded for the final track to commence. And that's when it happened. Bellowing through the speakers, the debauched, warbling sneer of Sid Vicious. And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain. Don't know if you've heard that version. The entire gathering stood stock still as the contemptuous obscenity in the next line of the song reverberated around the chapel. There was a pause, an intake of breath, and then in one gloriously anarchic moment, every single soul erupted into rapturous applause and laughter. Jim, you crazy bugger, one man shouted above the tumult. We love you. We love you, the congregation hollered back in unison as if it had all been rehearsed. Everybody laughed and cried and laughed all the way to the pub. Frank Sinatra's My Way is probably the nation's favourite funeral song, but no one, in my experience, had before requested the Sex Pistols version of it until Jim. And I swear I heard Jim giggling in the background as the congregation stood there open-mouthed. Jim was HIV positive and died of an AIDS-related illness. We met in the hospital where he spent his final months and where I served as the chaplain. Our many conversations on the ward focused mostly on music and football. Jim was allergic to religion, which is why it surprised me when he asked if I would take his funeral. I find it strange, you know, and slightly disconcerting to plan someone's funeral with the person sitting there in front of me, large as life. I never get used to that. But Jim eased the process with his dark humour and his reassuring down-to-earth manner. When it came to discussing the final song, he stuck to his guns, despite a barrage of protests from his partner, Mario. "It'll be a blast," Jim said, grinning from ear to ear. "I only wish I could be there to see their faces." "Yeah, that's the problem," Mario piped up. "I will be there." We laughed and laughed like three mates sharing a joke in the bar after work. Just before leaving, I reached out across the bed to give Jim a hug. He recoiled sharply and exclaimed, "No, Dave, no, Dave, don't touch me, don't touch me. I'm unclean." "Unclean?" I said. "What on earth are you talking about, unclean?" Well, it turned out that in his early teens, Jim attended a church with a tub-thumping sermon about the abomination of homosexuality. He'd known he was gay from being a young boy, but he'd never told anyone until he confessed to that vicar. After that, he became engulfed in weeks of so-called counselling, which was actually nothing short of emotional abuse. Week in, week out, the vicar attempted to deliver Jim from a spirit of homosexuality. And being a confused teenager, he just went along with this, trying his best to change, to become normal. But surprise, surprise, it all came to nothing. Jim still fancied boys, not girls. So he ditched church and religion and came out to his friends and family and got on with his life as a young gay man. Years later, after contracting HIV, he met Mario. They fell madly in love and lived happily together for 10 years prior to his death. And yet, despite turning his back on religion, Jim never quite managed to root out the shame that was embedded in his teenage psyche. And when I went to hug him, that's what all burst forth. "The last time a man of the cloth put his arm round me," he said, "it was to tell me lovingly that I would go to hell if I didn't stop looking at boys." Jim paused, winced, and then said, But what if he's right, Dave? What if the man upstairs really doesn't like gays, people like me? What if... Okay, stop right there, Jim, I said. Let's get this clear right now. Being gay is not a sin. It's in the same category as being left-handed or having red hair or being a boy instead of a girl. It's not something that you can do anything about at all. You can't help it. It's normal. No one chooses to be gay. It's just who you are, right? Right, he said. Trust me, Jim, you were misled. God loves you just as you are, a beautiful gay man. You have flaws like the rest of us, but being gay is not one of them. We hugged and wept. And actually, Jim turned out to be one of the best huggers I've ever known. We embraced many times in the weeks that followed. And yes, I did manage to convince him that God likes fags, as he cheekily enjoyed putting it, that God liked him. You know, I've got a basically sunny disposition. You can ask my wife. She's over here. I don't rile easily, but what really and truly gets my goat is the misery that is inflicted often in the name of God. On the way home from that hospital that day, I pulled over the car over, too angry to cry, though I wanted to. And sitting there at the side of the road in silent indignation, I contemplated what sort of God makes a man feel unclean for loving another man with all the passion, tenderness, and commitment that I feel toward my wife? No God that I can recognize or that I want anything to do with, that's for sure. So there and then, I resolved to be an atheist in the face of any God or religion that torments the likes of Jim, or that increases rather than diminishes the sum of human misery. If God exists, she or he has to be better than this. In my earlier days as a Christian, you know, it all seemed so straightforward. When someone asked me if I believed in God, I could respond very confidently, yes, of course I believed in God. Nowadays, it feels rather more complicated. It really depends on which God you have in mind. So let me be clear. I certainly do not believe in any old white man with a beard sitting in the heavens. I don't believe in a God who treats gay people as deviants or unclean. I don't believe in a God who inspires vengeance and war or incites bigotry and sectarianism. I don't believe in a God who consigns people to everlasting torment for not accepting Jesus. I don't believe in a God who presides over the world like some fat controller in the sky, deciding where and when to intervene in human affairs. I don't believe in a God who has some absolute plan or design for our lives or for the world to which we are supposed to conform or else. So what sort of God do I believe in? Well, that's exactly what my book or my manifesto of sorts is really all about. And the problem starts with this G word. God. As I say, I think we need to reinvent God, or at least reinvent the way we think about or imagine God. Basically, this man upstairs kind of God, controlling everything and randomly intervening in human affairs, is basically dead and gone to most people in today's world. And good job, I say. That sort of God no longer makes sense to most people. But that doesn't mean that people have abandoned God, or that they've abandoned the spiritual quest. People, I think, are still God seekers, by whatever name. People say to me all the time, I'm not religious, I don't really believe in God, but I do think there is something there. So I say, okay, forget God. Forget religious jargon, and translate that something that you do believe in into terms which make sense to you, and that'll be the beginning of your spiritual journey. And in the Bad Christians Manifesto, I'm trying to help people with that process, with thinking about notions of God, which are not necessarily religious, but nevertheless very real. After all, God is just that, a word. The word is just a word. The reality to which it refers or to which it points, I am profoundly committed to, and I believe in with all my heart. But I'm not really going to fight any battles about words, because I think this reality is more than words. And too many Christians and too many religious people have persecuted, killed, and excommunicated each other and whatever else they could think of because of words, because of forms of words, rather than the reality of a God revealed in the Bible to be basically love. God is love, and those who live in love live in God, and God lives in them. To be honest, when some religious people talk about God, I think I really would rather be an atheist. And when some atheists talk about the God they don't believe in, I find I totally agree with them. I don't believe in that God either, and I would gladly join their ranks if that's the only God that's on offer. But you know what? Arguments about God are boring. That's the truth. I'm a lot more interested in how we experience whatever it is that we call God than in arguments about God. I've argued about doctrine till the cows come home, and they came home and they went back again and they came home again. And you know, it's just a whole pile of hot air, really. This is not surely what God is all about. And so this is what I'm trying to explore in this book. How do we experience God? How can we experience God? Perhaps without even knowing that that is what we're experiencing. In the second chapter of the book, I tell the story of my relationship with Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans. I don't know if you know who they are. Sanderson was here, I think, last year, actually. He and Pippa are the founders of something called the Sunday Assembly, which has been dubbed in the press as the Atheist Church. Though it's interesting that Sanderson is really working very hard at the moment to completely abandon the word atheist in relationship to the Sunday Assembly. And in fact, if you want to set up a Sunday Assembly under that name, then you have to subscribe to their values, one of which is that you will not be anti-religious, because he says he wants it to be an inclusive community of people. Well, I met Sanderson very early on in the life of the Sunday Assembly. I think they'd only had a couple of services at that time. And I'd sent him a copy of How to Be a Bad Christian. And we met in a cafe near the Angel Islington. And I went there and the book was sitting on the table already. And he said, you know, I think that your approach to God, to Christianity, is very similar to my approach to atheism. By which I think he meant that neither of us was fundamentalists. You know, he's a long way from being a Richard Dawkins, who Sanderson said to me last Sunday, he said, I think that Richard Dawkins is now the servant of God to turn people back to God. So Sanderson asked me if, after we'd talked, and he asked me a whole lot of questions, basically about what it's like to be a vicar, because suddenly he was plunged into being that in his own way. And he then sent me an email and said, this may sound a weird question, and please feel free to say no, but would you consider being my mentor? So I thought, this could make an interesting conversation with the bishop. But basically, that is what has proceeded. And in fact, only a week ago, as I say, we met for a drink. And that was as a result of him saying, could we have a conversation about how to train up vicars? Because they call them hosts in the Sunday Assembly. But he said, you know, we want to know, what is it that makes a good host? And how can we kind of train people into this role and so on? And so that was a conversation that we had. As I say, I describe more about that relationship in the book. But it's, for me, been a really exciting encounter, because I look at the Sunday Assembly, where I've preached a couple of times to an absolutely jam-packed audience, not as many as here, but it was in a smaller space, jammed out with bright-eyed looking young people, basically, as far as I'm concerned, hungry for spirituality, hungry for what I call God, though they're put off for all sorts of good reasons that I've mentioned, I think, about by that word God. And the sermon I gave at the first one actually is in the appendix of the new book. But basically what I've found there is a symptom, I think, of something that I think is in society generally, that I think there are hordes and hordes and hordes of people who are in their own way God seekers, who are hungry for God, who are on a spiritual quest of some sort or other, but who are never going to dream of walking through the doors of a church. And that is a massive challenge to those of us who are inside church. What are we going to do? How are we going to connect with this wave, I think, of hunger that is out there in our world today? And as I say, an awful lot of it comes down to, what do we mean by the word God, and what does that conjure up in our minds, and what do we experience with the word God? I don't really think of God as some kind of entity or a being among other beings that exists in another part of the universe. That's not how I think of God. God to me is being itself, as Paul Tillich famously put it. God is the life-giving spirit who is the basis of all being. Wherever there is the sparkle of true life, to my mind, there is God. And so, actually, I don't even think that God exists. You can quote me. In any sense that we actually understand existence. I think existence is far too small a word to think about God. God doesn't exist. God is existence. God transcends any and every notion of being or existence that we as human beings can imagine, which is why I like to think of God more as being like the air that is all around us and within us. Speaking to a pagan audience at Athens, Paul famously said that in him we live and move and have our being. And so that, to me, I'm much more comfortable with the thought of God being that which surrounds us and which is a part of every scrap of the universe. Our friend Jenny, excuse me, I'm just going a bit dry. Our friend Jenny is a very good example of someone who just couldn't get past this sort of vision of God, this man upstairs, if you like. Before she died, she used to stay in our home a couple of times each year when she visited London with her work. And invariably, we'd end up having deep conversations well into the night, often consuming more red wine than we should. Jenny didn't have a religious bone in her body, but she had a great zest for life and a passion for justice in the world. If there was a good cause there to be supported, she was supporting it. She was a woman of deep spirituality, if not religion, and we shared an awful lot in common. But in one conversation at about 2:30 a.m., she seemed to get agitated and concerned that our views may be converging a little too much. Sipping nervously on her red wine, she said, "But you need to remember, Dave, I am an atheist." So I said, "Do you know what, Jenny? You're about as much an atheist as I am." And I pronounced this with the kind of pomposity that I only ever really attain with the influence of alcohol. "So how do you make that out?" she said. "Well, because you are one of the most spiritually motivated people that I know," I said, "and ultimately we believe in the same thing. It's just that I call it God and you don't." Now, that was the night I think that I managed to convince Jenny that when I say God, I'm not talking about a big guy upstairs. Jenny was a woman who wrestled with ultimate questions. She was on a faith journey, regardless of how she chose to name it. So was she really an atheist? Well, not in the terms that Paul Tillich uses in his writings in the late 20th century. He argues that a real atheist is someone who denies that there is any ultimate concern. In other words, that life is entirely meaningless. Now, this certainly was not Jenny. And it's not most atheists that I know. We may not share God talk, but we do share ultimate concern, the sense of there being something beyond all of this. When all the paraphernalia of specific religious tradition is stripped away, I think there are basically just two truths that a genuine religious sense requires. Every other doctrine derives in some way from these two things. The first one is that our lives are embraced by mystery. In a lovely old book, which is entitled Living Philosophies, a series of intimate credos, Albert Einstein wrote these words. He said, "The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. He to whom the emotion is a stranger, who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapped in awe, is as good as dead. his eyes are closed. The insight into the mystery of life, coupled though it be with fear, has also given rise to religion. To know what is impenetrable to us really exists, manifesting self as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling, is at the center of true religiousness. Einstein emphasized that he could not imagine a God who rewards and punishes the objects of his creation, whose purposes are modeled after our own, a God, in short, who is but a reflection of human frailty. And yet what he describes and names as the mysterious equates fundamentally with what I understand as the divine. All religions stress in some way that God is a mystery that cannot ultimately be put into words or reduced to human categories. Within Christianity, the most profound understanding of God, which is known as the apophatic tradition or the via negativa, maintains that the closer that we get to God, the less we can comprehend God. To commune with the divine is, in fact, to enter a deep and deafening silence. And yet each of us is embraced by this mystery, whether or not we're religious, and we become aware of it through occasional mindful epiphanies that break through our normal inattentiveness, breathing hope and warmth into our soul. Things like the sense of awesome tininess when we gaze into a starry sky on a dark night, watching a newborn lamb struggling to find its feet for the first time, smelling the top of a baby's head. I love that one, don't you? Listening to the full-hearted evensong of a blackbird on a late autumn afternoon just before the sun drops. Getting lost in your favourite piece of music, merging with a loved one on a settee without a word being uttered. This knowledge, this feeling, Einstein says, is the centre of true religiousness. To know that what is impenetrable to us really exists. One person may declare the whole earth is full of God's glory. Another may simply draw a deep breath and feel, wow, it's good to be alive. But it's the sense of being embraced by mystery that unites us and directs us toward what Tillich calls ultimate concern. The second basic truth, I think, is that this mystery is gracious. Einstein also once said that the most important question facing humanity is the universe a friendly place? If we decide that the universe is an unfriendly place, he said, then we will use all our resources to create bigger walls to keep out the unfriendliness. And if we decide that the universe is neither friendly nor unfriendly, and that God is playing dice with the universe, then we're simply victims to the random toss of the dice, and our lives have no real purpose or meaning. But if we decide that the universe is indeed a friendly place, then, he said, we will devote ourselves to creating tools and models for understanding that universe, which is what he understood as science. As we've already said, Einstein rejected the notion of a theistic big guy upstairs, but he concluded that the universe is friendly. God does not play dice with the universe, he said. Our lives do indeed have meaning and purpose. But is it true? Is the universe friendly? What about the unfriendliness that we experience in the world? Not just the hostility too often found in human relations, which we see plenty of right now, but the brutality of sickness and suffering and the oft-time inhospitableness of nature itself, the storms and the floods, the droughts and the famines and so on. Perhaps it's more accurate to say that the universe is an ambiguously friendly place. We can't deny that there is unfriendliness at all kinds of levels. But the greater truth is the triumph of the human spirit. People find ways through even the most painful experiences. Love does overcome evil. Hope does rise in the most desperate of situations. Something embedded in the depth of human existence tells us that the mystery at the heart of the universe is trustworthy, and that our fulfillment lies in surrendering to it. In Christianity, grace, of course, is the central expression of the divine mystery, symbolized in the self-emptying love of Christ. The crucifixion, as far as I understand it, is not an angry, despotic God demanding bloodthirsty restitution through the death of his son. It's about a crucified God who is always immersed in the pain and suffering and brutality of the world. God is never distant, always present. But we don't need to be religious to know that the mystery of life can sustain us, that we can deal with whatever comes along if we remain open and receptive to the grace that's rooted in the depth of creaturely existence. So from these two truths, the sense of mystery and its graciousness, we can derive all the other important ideas of religion. Religion is often made far too complicated and forbidding. The rest is important, of course it is. But what we all truly need to know as human beings is that we are accepted by that which is greater than us, whose name none of us finally knows, not really. Faith, I repeat, is the state of being ultimately concerned, of being gripped and driven by something that we are convinced is of fundamental importance and which places an unconditional demand upon us. Faith is also the attitude of full-hearted openness to the mystery of life, entrusting the soul to life's immensity. And sometimes that takes courage as well as vision. And I hasten to say that sometimes faith, by the definition I've just given you, is far more evident amongst people outside of church, outside of Christianity and religion generally, than it is in people who are regular churchgoers or religious people. And the courage and the vision that goes with that sort of faith is far more evident, I think, at times, beyond the flap of the tent of religion. And yet we need to picture God. You know, what I've described could end up really as just this great abstraction, but we can't live with that, really. We need to picture God. The problem is, I think, that many images of God in religion actually drive people away from God, which is why, ironically, considering I'm a vicar, I sometimes advise people to give up religion, at least for the time being. Why? Well, for their own mental health's sake. To stop reading the Bible, to stop praying and going to church, because the vision of God created or reinforced by this religious activity is actually destroying them psychologically and emotionally. Brenda is a very good example of what I'm talking about. She grew up in a staunchly Christian home, controlled by her obsessively religious father. She attended church, prayed and read her Bible dutifully from childhood, and yet the God that she internalized from those activities also wrecked her life. Under the shadow of a horribly disapproving dad who criticized her mercilessly, the heavenly father that she came to know turned out to be a larger-than-life expression of him, her contemptible earthly father. When I met Brenda in her mid-30s, she had almost no self-esteem, despite being a very bright and beautiful woman with a successful career. She could recite verses from the Bible and utter religious platitudes about God's love over and over again, but in her heart she believed that God disapproved of virtually everything about her. God may love me, she told me once, but he definitely doesn't like me. Basically, God made Brenda's life a misery. I often think about committing suicide, she told me, but I'm afraid I'll go to hell if I do. She looked disconcerted when I told her that she should stop reading the Bible and praying and seek some therapy instead. But after 6 months of no church, no Bible, and no prayer, and the help of a good therapist, she wrote me an email which read, "When you told me to stop practicing my faith, I was devastated, outraged. I wasn't sure that I should trust you. You snatched away my security blanket. But everything is falling into place now. I was clinging to the thing that hurt me most. I'm starting to believe that instead of being angry at my failure, God may have actually grieved at my upbringing. His anger may have been directed at my father and the church rather than at me. Perhaps God likes me after all." At a later meeting, I asked Brenda if there was anyone who she felt really, really, really did love her. "My grandma," she replied enthusiastically with a big grin across her face. "What is it about your grandmother that makes you so happy?" I said. And she proceeded to tell me how, when she was a small child at her grandmother's home, she knocked over a treasured vase, a family heirloom. Knowing how important the vase was, the little girl screamed as it crashed to the ground and smashed into pieces. But when her grandmother rushed into the room, there was no anger, no recrimination, just relief. "Thank God," she said. "I thought you were hurt." And gathered Brenda into her arms and hugged her close. Recalling the story with teary eyes, Brenda said to me with a sense of self-worth which I hadn't seen in her so far, "And that was the day I discovered that I was my grandmother's family treasure." "Brenda," I said, looking her straight in the eyes, "what if God is like your grandmother and not like your dad? How would it change things if you imagined God as a warm, motherly figure who gathers you into her arms when you do something wrong, instead of the harsh father figure who's admonishing you?" And she just paused for a moment while that idea percolated through her head. "Can I really picture my gran when I think about God?" she said. "Why not?" I said. Reinventing God, or at least reinventing the image and notion of God etched in her psyche, transformed Brenda's life for the better. She dumped the idea that God in any way resembled her wretched father and then began to flourish with a sense of inner acceptance. So is God like Brenda's grandma? Well, yes. But God, as I've said, is a mystery beyond all our imagining. No representation of God can be taken literally. So of course God's not literally like Brenda's grandmother. And yet it's impossible to exaggerate the difference that it made to Brenda to reinvent God, to begin to see God through the lens of her grandmother's love. Time and time again, I try to help people pastorally to reinvent God, to reinvent some of these entrenched notions of God, to dump critical, punitive, and undermining images, often based on parents, teachers, vicars, and other authority figures, and to replace them with a sense of a loving, compassionate, and empowering presence in their life. In some instances, I explicitly encourage people to reimagine God in their own ethnic likeness, to picture God, for example, as a black woman or man. Do you know, I feel devastated that so many non-white people that I have talked to over the years picture God as a white male. I recently encouraged a young Asian woman to adopt a spiritual practice of drawing pictures of God as an Asian mother figure, as a way of loving herself, loving her ethnicity, loving her genetic heritage, and discovering in the process an entirely different experience of God. How can anyone sense that they are beloved children of God if they experience God as ethnically and culturally alien to who they are? Now, of course, God is no more or less an Asian woman than a European man. God surpasses categories of race and gender. And yet, the heart of the Christian message is that God penetrates and inhabits humanity. Not one particular strand of humanity, one gender or ethnicity, but all of humanity. The Christian affirmation that God indwelt Jesus Christ does not mean that God is a first century Jewish man, but that God became flesh and blood time and time and time again in every expression of humanity, male and female, gay and straight, black and white, rich and poor, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, and atheist. Sometimes I have a church full of non-churchgoers gathered for a baptism or a wedding, and I invite them sometimes to take a few moments of quiet. I ask them to place their feet on the floor and then breathe and focus on the young child or on the couple who are getting married. After a short while, I ask them to open their eyes and then tell them that they've just prayed. People with no particular religious beliefs have told me that they have no idea that praying was so easy. One woman said, "If it's like that, then I'm going to start praying every day." Conscious breathing is one of the simplest and most effective ways of connecting us to the life force which I call God. That's how close God is, as near as our breath. Many people will never come near a church who do not think of them. Many people who will never come near a church who don't think of themselves as even remotely religious, experience an occasional feeling of ecstatic oneness with the mystery behind everything. For example, when gazing into the heavens at night or standing in the midst of an open space in the country and feeling that they're a very tiny part of something vast and great. And this also is a form of prayer. Let me finish with one more story. Jean, she came from a particularly non-religious background. When we met to discuss her sister's funeral, she told me how she'd been sucked into a life of drug-taking and prostitution in the King's Cross area of London. She'd fled home as a young teenager to escape the abuse of her father and slept rough. Her knight in shining armour turned out to be a pimp. Drugs helped for a while, but then things got worse until one night she found a back entrance into a tall building in central London and climbed the fire escape stairs until she made her way onto the roof with a bottle of whiskey and some pills. Lying on top of the building, she gazed into the sky and saw stars, thousands and thousands of stars. "I'd never done that since I was a little girl," she said. "I stared and stared and thought how perfect and how peaceful it all looked, so different to my sick life. And that's when I decided not to kill myself. I suddenly felt as if I was in this massive womb about to be born. Something was looking after me." Jean wasn't religious in any sense. She didn't go to church or claim to be a Christian. But when I suggested it to her, she readily recognized that the something looking after her was God. By the time we met, she'd been in recovery from drink and drugs for 13 years and now works with a team going out on the streets of King Cross, befriending girls who live like she once did, offering them support and counseling. She didn't have a religious conversion as such, and yet her life was transformed by discovering that she wasn't alone in the world, that God was, if you like, behind her sofa the whole time. I've sometimes had a similar experience to Jean in the midst of crowds of people like you here today, but also at a rock concert or a football match or even walking through central London. I've sensed a sudden oneness with people in their joy or sorrow. Something connects us deep down, and I think that something is God, the all-encompassing spirit of life. If we sense this is not only personally transforming, it can also transform our relationships, it could transform society and our world in general. So let me finish with these few points, which are my simple manifesto, a bad Christian's manifesto. First of all, to follow the way of Jesus rather than rules and conventions. To doubt and question without fear, and never be daunted by orthodoxies and authority figures. To make a priority of kindness and compassion and pursue justice for all people. To embrace messiness and imperfection while aspiring to be all that we can be. To live courageously and resist being motivated by guilt or fear. So much religion is motivated by guilt and fear. So many people I talk to and counsel are basically living a Christian life, a religious life, based on fear and guilt. Next, to love the world and honour it as God's body. To have parties, laugh often, enjoy friends and welcome strangers. To resist passing judgment and befriend people on the margins. And finally, to look for God in every single person and situation. This is my manifesto. Thank you.
The good news is, on two counts, firstly, this talk has been recorded, so if you had trouble hearing at the back, then you can order it from G-Store. Also, the other part of the good news is there is some time for questions. The slightly not good news is that you're going to have to really shout loud because we can't get the microphone to you. So any questions, hands up, and then shout as loud as you can.
Dave, I remember the days when you were a young man with lots of hair. Spring Harvest. Quite a journey since willing to say a sentence or two about that, Judith?
So the question was that this gentleman here remembers me when I was a young man with quite a lot of hair and a speaker at Spring Harvest and such places. And obviously I've been on a journey, so what's that all about? You know, I think that there are a lot of people who think that that it is a virtue to basically remain the same, you know, and that, you know, that faith is about sort of, you know, steadfastness in the sense of just remaining true constantly to the same old things. I don't believe that at all. I think faith is much more about courage than it is about sort of convention and sort of conservatism. And so it seems to me that if we are not changing and evolving as people, then something's wrong. We're not really on a journey. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I'm a different person entirely to who I was when I had her and did all those other things. Because actually, you know, there was integrity about who I was at that time. I was true to what I believed. I was true to what I was. I was gripped by an ultimate concern, you know, which I put into a form of words that I now find I would struggle with, that I don't really believe in the same way. But actually, the ultimate concern remains the same. The problem is that I think an awful lot of people are sitting in those conferences, sitting in those churches, going along this nice little Christian route without truly being gripped by an ultimate concern. They can paraphrase all the verses and all the kind of the nice phrases about being a Christian, but actually they're not on a journey. They're not kind of gripped by something down inside. And that's why, you know, I find it sort of frustrating and invigorating to meet people completely outside of church who couldn't possibly use the words about God that I'm comfortable to use, and yet who I feel are on precisely the same journey, who are gripped by that ultimate concern, which is, of course, what I was trying to get out in writing How to Be a Bad Christian. So, you know, I think that, you know, I can look back on those days and sort of smile, certainly when I see the pictures of lots of hair, and weep. But, you know, it's still me, but I've been on a journey, and I hope to carry on. So that's why I would say, you know, don't sort of take everything that I'm saying today on the basis that I would say them all in 10 more years' time if I happen to be still alive and I'm here at Greenbelt, because I hope I'll have moved on there, you know? So, you know, I think we're always looking at snapshots of where we're up to on this journey, but the important thing is the integrity with which we pursue that ultimate concern that grips us deep down, which I'm very comfortable to describe as God.
At the beginning, you were talking about religion and negative terms. Where, you claim because they're words, and they're just words, there's a sense of why are we concerned with these things? They're just words. Why they have so much power? And then the argument moves to what? Either I can't think about the question, or the argument moves to the question of what is love? If love is just a word. And if God is just a word, and God is love, and love is just a word, I'm wondering, weighing those two things.
Yeah, I mean, so the question is about words, and that I talked at the beginning saying that often religious words are just words, and but the truth, of course, is, you know, I've already spouted out onto you today quite a lot of words. You know, I'm a word person. Words are important to me. Words are important to us all. So I'm not rubbishing words. But what I'm saying is that that sometimes we may struggle to put things into words, or we put them into words and we know they're not really the best words, or they can't really encompass this. So I think words are a medium that we possess to try to express things that we experience. And sometimes we'll feel more comfortable with those words than we will at other times. But really, I'm not saying that words are unimportant. I engage in arguments about words constantly. And I want to get the word, you know, I certainly don't want to stand up and speak a load of bunkum in words, you know, so I want to get the words as right as I can. So words are clearly important. But yes, it is true that in the end, we know that the deepest and most important things that we experience in life can't in the end be put into words. And I suppose that's really what I'm trying to say, that because there are people who do not use the same words religiously, in fact, use that word broadly that I use, perhaps for very good reasons, that doesn't mean to say that they are not experiencing the same thing that I'm experiencing. That's really all I'm trying to say. You have to shout. Was someone down here? Oh, sorry, yes.
So when you're talking about having an ultimate concern, is that basically
you? Ultimate concern, yes.
So what about people who are very, very concerned, and feel that they have very strong ultimate concern for, say, killing other people, or something that we would see as completely apart from God and completely not about God at all?
Yep. No, it's a very good question. So the question was, you know, ultimate concern, what about people who feel that they have an ultimate concern about hurting and killing other people, or about pursuing their own kind of selfish ends or whatever? Yeah, so obviously, ultimate concern are more words that one would have to sort of put some content into. And so I don't think that people feeling passionate about something automatically validates it or makes it good or right. There has to be some criteria from which to judge that or assess that. And I suppose that, you know, at its best, this is what kind of religious traditions try to do. They create values, you know, by whatever means or whatever words that they feel express things that are good rather than bad. So, you know, that's a journey that we always have to be on, I think, of trying to refine what we mean by these things. So, yes, I think that, you know, in the way I've used the term ultimate concern here today, I think that I'm equating that in my mind with things that the Christian values give me at the deepest level, which is about love and is about sacrifice and is about justice and kindness and so on and so forth. So it's a, you know, it's a good question, but we have to have some criteria from which to come at that. And then, you know, you get into whole arguments about, well, you know, where do you get that criteria from? And, you know, I think at the end of the day, we have no kind of objective source that we can go to where you can go and look this up in the library, as it were, and there it is, it's all spelled out. That's part of the spiritual journey, I think. And for me, it's informed deeply by my Christian faith, but also by what I sense is written into my humanity. It's interesting, isn't it, that I don't think that there's any religious tradition or serious philosophical position that I know of that says that hatred is a good thing, you know. I think, you know, all traditions, I mean, the golden rule, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, is something which is embedded in some form in every single religious tradition on earth. But also, you know, humanists too would sort of adhere to that. So, you know, it's a process I think we have to constantly come back and revisit. But I think that when the Bible says that God is love, I think that is the most profound and also the most inclusive statement in the Bible, really. And I would that would be my basic criteria.
I've just got a question, quite a serious question, related to religion and all that, carry on. Do you have a favourite superhero?
So the question is, do I have a favourite superhero? Do you mean a religious superhero? Any superhero? From the comic books. Oh, right. Okay. I've always been quite partial to Batman, really. Yeah. I kind of like the light and dark, you know?
Yeah, that's
Yeah, I light and dark is good, I think. Yep.